founded, or specialism, I should say, he founded, has been the subject of 23 different scholarly Haikita symposia. The titles of his books, I think, are great and show his range and the depth of his thought. I'll just read out a few of them. Social Epistemology, Kuhn versus Popper, The Struggle for the Soul of Science, a work I've read and you cannot put it down. The Intellectual, and most intriguingly, Dissent over Descent, which is a defense of the right to teach intelligent design, a school of thought which is controversial, one I'm sympathetic to as well. And one thing I like about Steve is that he's prepared in the public arena to defend controversial and sometimes unpopular ideas. He reminds me of how Aristotle was once described. Worse, Aristotle himself is alleged to have said, when he broke with his Platonist patrons, he said, "I preferred truth to friendship." And not that Steve's unpopular at all, he's extremely popular, and I'm sure his personality will shine through in this talk. He's going to speak on the place of values in the world of information, an extremely important topic, I'm sure you'll agree. The format is, he's going to talk for about 40 minutes, and then I'll open it up for discussion. This is not a public lecture, and I'm very happy with the turnout. We're in a lecture theatre only, because I wanted the room to be, on advice from my PhD student Lynn, who used to be head of equality in the NHS, I wanted it to be disability friendly. So that's the only reason you're in a rather formal setting. Let's have an intimate, interactive, and exciting conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Steve Fuller.
Okay. First of all, Alistair, I'm going to dispose of this because nothing's working. It doesn't matter.
You need a word file.
No, nothing. That doesn't matter. I can speak. We don't need anything.
So turn it off then.
Yeah, turn it off. First of all, I want to thank Alistair for inviting me here and for all of you showing up today. The topic that I want to raise is about the place of value in a world of information. And in a way, I want to kind of get into this topic historically, but bring it up to date so we see what's kind of on the table here for us who want to think about this notion in the 21st century. It's interesting. Alistair raised in his introduction the fact, comparing me to Aristotle. So why don't I begin there? I think if one of the things, we take the notion of value very much for granted, but it has a very particular history within philosophy. If you were to go back to the ancient Greeks, and in particular with somebody like Aristotle, if you were talking about the value of a human life, what makes a human life valuable, okay, you would be basically talking about a certain kind of normative set point. Okay. In other words, and it would be understood as a kind of equilibrium where you're bringing into balance lots of different things that you have to do in order to live. And as it were, the value of your life comes from the coherence that results from being able to integrate all those different kinds of activities that constitute your life. And to achieve a good life is to achieve that set point. And for each individual, it would be different. And that's kind of where the value of life would come from. And this is an idea, of course, and you can perhaps tell by the way I've been phrasing it, that carries on into the modern period, into the 20th century, as the idea of an organism being in equilibrium with its environment. Right? That kind of conception of value, right, where you talk about an organism living a flourishing life and so forth by being able to get the most it can out of the environments in which it normally lives, which is an idea that's still very much with us within biology, is, I think, what Aristotle's original notion about what the value of life was. Okay? Now, when you move into the Christian era, you get a kind of different, and in a way, a kind of much more, you might say, inflated notion of value, because we're talking about the value of life not simply in terms of the value of particular life forms, but we're talking about the value of life as part of some overall intelligent design or plan, okay? And Alistair alluded to one of my controversial works, Dissent over Descent, which is a kind of a defense of intelligent design theory. And whatever else one wants to say about intelligent design theory, it keeps that idea alive, right? That there's a sense in which the value of life has to be seen in the ultimate whole, not just in terms of the value of particular individuals living at particular times, but in terms of how those lives fit into some kind of larger scheme of things. So as it were, the full value of one's life may not be fully realizable within one's lifetime, right? It will take something more, you know? And so this idea of thinking that the value of life is something that isn't realized at the time of living, but is somehow perhaps realized by others in the future, or, you know, maybe in some transcendent realm or something, right? If you take the Christian cosmology very seriously, right? That this is a different kind of notion where value has to be seen in some kind of sense of ultimate whole, and that you can't talk about the value of things in particular. Okay? Now, in this kind of discussion, so all these things I've been talking about so far pretty much gets us up to about the late 18th century. And during this period, up to the late 18th century, we really don't have a discussion of this in the name of value, right? So we talk about the meaning of life, we can talk about the worth of beings and so forth, but the idea of value itself and the fact that there might be multiple values, because think about the way in which we use value normally in English, right, is this idea that there are lots of values. And in fact, when in social science, for example, we talk about, the fact that facts are value-laden, right, and that people are always operating from their value standpoint, right? When we start talking that way, we're entering into a very modern sense of talking about the notion of value, and that really only begins in the late 18th century, and Immanuel Kant is really the point man for this kind of idea, okay? And so, to a large extent, insofar as we tend to think about values as inherently pluralistic things, different people have different values, right? When we start talking that way, right, this is a Kantian legacy, okay, from Immanuel Kant. And part of the issue here, where does this idea come from? Well, part of the issue here has to do with actually a crisis, you might say, in our understanding of the Christian worldview that takes place at the end of the 18th century. Because, look, if you believe that there is some intelligent design to reality, and you believe that there is some divine plan out there, there is a sense in which you are committed to the idea that you can get into the mind of God, right, somehow. Okay, science may do it, theology may do it, some discipline may get you there, but at the end you can figure out what it all means. Okay, this is what Kant puts into doubt. Okay, Kant puts this idea into doubt, and in the sense that you can no longer think about the idea of value as something that's oriented towards some sort of ultimate goal state, like the mind of God. But rather, value has to be thought of in a somewhat more downscaled kind of way. So value starts to be associated with particular ways of approaching the world. Okay? And that's at least at the first instance. And I don't know, maybe some of you have heard of this guy Habermas. Does Habermas still mean anything in the 21st century? I don't know. I mean, he's a kind of 20th century artifact, part of that social democratic culture that existed during the Cold War era, but rapidly dissolved after that, now that we've all become neoliberal. But Habermas was some guy who early in his career, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, right, was talking about the various kinds of values that are attached to various kinds of what he called, cognitive interests, right, different ways of knowing the world. Okay? And there were different, and there was a value, as it were, attached to each of these different ways of knowing the world. And so you could have a purely cognitive way of knowing the world, which is, in terms of purely theoretical, intellectual, the kind of thing one thinks of pure physics and so forth in that reign. One can also have purely instrumental form of knowledge, where what you're into is kind of, power and control over phenomena. And you can have so-called practical knowledge, which has to do with the knowledge that you acquire by just being in the world with other similarly minded beings. Okay, so you have all these different, and each of these things have, as it were, certain kinds of values attached to the knowledge that's produced. Okay, this is a very Kantian way of looking at things, and Habermas, you might say, is kind of the last guy down the road who still promotes this kind of idea. Okay, now one of the things that starts to happen already in the 19th century, so within like a two generations after Kant, and certainly moving into the 20th century, and if you think about somebody like Max Weber, for example, who's living in the beginning of the 20th century, you start to get this idea that in some sense, value is irreducibly plural, right? In a sense, almost every, each individual in each act has their own value, right? And as it were, only they know what it is, and there isn't really, as it were, something factual about this. It's something else, right? It's what drives them, it's what moves them. And this may, in fact, change. It kind of has a radical subjectivity to it. Let's put it that way, right? That value has a radical subjectivity to it. And this is something that Max Weber very much promotes. He thinks this, in fact, is one of the things that ends up prohibiting science from being able to tell us how should we run the world, right? Because the science can give us the facts, it can give us the laws, the regularities, and give us all that kind of stuff, but what it can't do is give us the what for, the why, right? It can't give us that. That is something we have to choose. So in this respect, right, Max Weber is a kind of a foregrounder of what would become existentialism later in the 20th century, right? This idea that the world itself, right, doesn't, you know, the more and more you know about the world, that doesn't necessarily give you a clearer value orientation, right? Because again, go back to the Christian worldview. And the Christian worldview, and this is where somebody like Leibniz, if you're familiar with some of these guys from the early modern period, right, they basically believe that the more and more you learn about the world, the more, in fact, you'll find out what the purpose of everything is. Right, so more knowledge will give you more value. Things will become clearer and clearer, and you'll know your place in nature, you'll know everything in nature, and you can, as it were, discover that fact. You can discover what the values are of the world. Okay, now with Kant, this gets stopped because of a general agnosticism about the existence of God. And then by the time we get to Max Weber in the 20th century, we have a kind of view that basically is skeptical about the idea that there can be values out there, but rather values are things that we project, they're subjective. Okay? Now this idea, as I was saying, Max Weber is foregrounding views that would become very popular in existentialism in the 1950s and 60s in the post-World War II era. But of course, where he's getting the idea from is from economics. Okay, neoclassical economics. Because if you think about it, right, economics, neoclassical economics, is actually quite skeptical or agnostic about where your values come from. It's just once your values are registered, we can then tell you what actually most efficiently realizes them. Right, but economics itself doesn't give you values. Economics takes value as a placeholder. And you put in the values you want, and then they tell you what's the best way to go about achieving them. And this is where Weber, in fact, because Weber was trained as an economist, this is one of the areas where he comes from on this. So economics, as a discipline, has traditionally been a very subjectivist view with regard to values. People forget this point because basically it doesn't enter into the thing we actually call economics, which is the stuff that happens after your values have been registered. Okay? And then we start to get all of the supply and demand curves and all the rest of it that make up the discipline. But the values themselves are subjective. They're just things that you yourself plug in to the equations, and then the equations take their course. Okay, and that's kind of where Weber is coming from on this, and that was one of the reasons why Weber, in fact, established the kind of interesting relationship that we still talk about the relationship between science and politics. Okay, right, where Weber says, you know, the politician is the one who makes the value choices for the people. He says, I want to do this, I want to do that, this is where we want to go, and so forth. And then the scientist tells you the most efficient way of getting there. But the scientist, him or herself, does not offer an opinion about the worthwhileness of the values. Right? So there's a division of labor that's going on there. Right? So whereas the politician, speaking on behalf of the people, provides the values, the scientist is providing the means, the instruments, and telling you which ones are more or less efficient. And this kind of, and this is where we get the kind of modern, kind of, you might say, settlement with regard to science and politics, and this idea of science as being value neutral comes from this kind of line of thinking, okay? Now, in the, now you get an interesting kind of, mathematically expressed version of this Weber worldview with regard to what happens to the concept of information as we move into the middle of the 20th century. And here, what I'm talking about is the kind of classic information theory idea from Shannon and Weaver. Okay? Because you think about what is information, right? And if you think about information as something that, as it were, something you should have, there's a kind of implicit value attached to having information, it is going to be relative to the context in which the receiver is operating. So information for one person isn't information for somebody else. It is very relativized. Okay, even though it's all mathematically expressed, and even though, you know, the examples are taken from walkie-talkies and other kind of technological gizmos, nevertheless, the fundamental view that we're talking about the value of information is subjective in a very strong way. At least it is very relativized, because the context determines everything. What counts as an information to someone is going to be something that actually enables them to make a decision that they weren't able to make before. And that is going to be relative to the background knowledge of the person concerned. So what I tell you may be redundant, and it is not information, because you already know it, and so it's not going to help you make a decision. But to somebody else, telling them the same thing may in fact count as information, because it does end up, they didn't know it before, and so it's going to enable them to make the decision. That is what the Shannon-Weaver information theory involves. Highly relativized notion of information, the value of information comes vis-a-vis the background knowledge, given the decision context in which you have to operate. You can't get anything more relativistic than that. And the fact that this is all couched in mathematics and that engineers do it and all the rest of it doesn't matter. Right? The fundamental ontology is very relativistic and very much in line with the kind of development that I have been talking about so far. Okay? Where you get this increasingly kind of relativized, subjectivized notion of information. Now, I want to sort of step back a little bit from this story, because in a sense I think this is where the story ends up going. But I want to talk about another kind of development which in a way intersects with this in interesting ways, and I think may become more important, especially in the kind of political economy in which we are dealing with information and communication technologies these days. Okay. And this has to do with the old-fashioned notion of commodification, okay? One of the things that when we talk about commodities and commodification in Marx, right, which is the sort of the locus classicus for this kind of thing, I think the key thing that to understand about this notion of commodity. It goes back to the Latin roots, and it's basically taking up a space. That's what commodious, right? We have this word in English, commodious, spacious, right? Right. Commodity is as it were, things that take up a space. And so, in a sense, what the capitalist does is to create a space that you always feel needs to be filled. And that's what the commodity, that's to create the commodity. So the commodity isn't actually the thing. It is the space that it and any and a wide variety of other things may fill. So when we talk about, you know, creating demand, creating wants, that's what we're talking about. That's where commodification enters, because you feel, I need something like this because I have this outstanding need. And there may be several different products that could satisfy this, but I have this need. Okay? Now, so commodification has to do with the construction and manufacture of wants. And this is one way in which you might think about the idea of value becoming objectified in what starts off to be a very subjective situation. Right? So again, think about it from the economist standpoint. From the economist standpoint, the ground zero standpoint is values are just numbers that individuals plug in differently into their, you know, into their rational calculus. But maybe you, as the capitalist producer, might figure out a way of actually organizing all of those different subjective choices so they all end up wanting the same thing. Okay? And that's commodification. So what you're doing when you commodify in the first instance is you're basically turning what would otherwise be individually subjective wants and desires and needs and so forth into something fairly general and abstract, which lots of people recognize as something they want. And that's how you generate a market, basically, right? And then a market surrounds that, and lots of different products compete to fill that thing. Okay? And this is kind of the way capitalism has proceeded, over the last couple of hundred years. So you get this kind of commodification of value, which essentially objectifies something that might otherwise just remain subjective. Okay. Now, how do we figure this out? If you're a capitalist, how do you figure it out? Well, obviously, one of the things that you can do is that you can ask people. Or, you know, as it was in the early days, I mean, if you think about the history of marketing in capitalism, in the beginning, right, capitalists just used to set out their stalls, used to advertise in the sense of telling you this stuff exists, go for it. But they weren't necessarily actively trying to shape you to want the thing. They were sort of operating on the assumption that in some sense you already want it, and now we're going to provide it for you. And you sort of second guess what the consumer might want. But of course, as we move in through the 19th and the 20th centuries, right, we get much more proactive approaches to this issue, right, whereby we do market research, we do polling, we do surveying, right, we in fact even induce demand, right? So there is this whole discussion, right, in economics and business literature about inducing demand, whereby basically the marketing part of the company, right, runs the show and say, okay, we need new stuff, and you know, we can produce it. Only problem is nobody yet wants it. We have to figure out how they're going to want it. And then you enable them, and then you show them how to want it. You teach them how to want it through your advertising, and sometimes even by involving these people in the creation of the products, participant design stuff, right? You do that too, right? And then you get them to want it, and you make a lot of money, okay? And that's kind of the way things kind of progressed over the course of the 20th century. Now, of course, we're in the 21st century, and we've got Google, right? And we have got, and so much of people's lives, you know, not only their purchasing patterns, but also just the normal way in which they conduct what they consider part of their meaningful lives, is actually being conducted online. Which is to say that more and more of your actual life is unobtrusively available to the people who run those networks through which your information is passing. Okay? So never before has anyone known so much about you. Okay? And this, of course, allows for enormous amounts of possibilities with regard to the creation of valuable products that people like you will want, because they will be created in your image and likeness. Okay? People figure out, this person does this, does that, buys here, buys there, right, etc., votes this pattern, that pattern, hits those web pages, that web page, right, and then will then dish out stuff just for you. Okay? Now, what's wrong with that? You might say. Because some people think this is a great thing, right? So, you know, in a sense, why do I have to think about what I really want or need when you've got, you know, the great God Google overseeing everything I'm doing and then instructs me as to, hey, you know, I've been looking at all of the things you've been buying lately, and this is the next thing you need. Right? Anyone who's ever dealt with Amazon knows this, right? Amazon is the great master of this, right? And people feel very empowered by this, right? They say, wow, I'm learning more and more about stuff. I'm becoming a better and better me. Right? It's like all of these search engines are instructing me on who I am. Because I only know it implicitly. Okay? So what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this? Well, I mean, I do think the problem is and this is where we go, let's go back to Marx now, right? The problem here is exploitation. I know you think it's obvious, but it's not so obvious to the people who buy into this, okay? And the context in which I want to put this in is that this issue that we're talking about, when people do get upset about it, it isn't usually talked about in terms of exploitation. Rather, people tend to talk about it in terms of the invasion of privacy. And that's a completely misleading way of talking about what's going on here. Right? So we've now, in this world in which we live, right? All of the critical people of the information world, right, are all up in arms about privacy. You know, Edward Snowden is the patron saint of, you know, the privacy stuff, right? And it seems to me this is really kind of the missed the point, at least from the standpoint of trying to come up with an adequate normative settlement for the sort of world that we're moving into now, okay? I think privacy is a mistaken way of thinking about what's happening here. The main problem with what's going on is that you don't actually have much control over this data that other people are getting from you. It is the power asymmetry that is involved. When Google is able to scoop up data from you and then able to produce products that you want, and you don't even know what data they've been scooping up, even though you're the one generating it. You're getting no value from the data being produced as data. You are never given an opportunity actually to use the data yourself. Rather, the data is being used by Google and then being repackaged into a product for you to buy. So you never have access to that raw material that you are in fact freely providing. That's exploitation. Okay? That is the problem with this kind of world in which we live. It is not an issue of privacy, because I think privacy is some kind of Eden-like, you know, nostalgia thing that people thought. There never really was privacy, right? I mean, privacy is not the issue. The issue is whether you can use your own data as much as others can, right? And whether that, because what is really diabolical is not that people collect data from you, but they can kind of use it against you, and you can't do anything about it. Okay, so this now, you know, what we're hinting at here, right, gets us into the issue of intellectual property, ownership of data. That's where the issue needs to be. Okay? How does one have a kind of reasonable settlement? Because of course, you would not be able to be searching the web and all this other stuff that you're able to do were it not for Google and Amazon and all the great gods of the internet world. Okay? But at the same time, that doesn't mean that they are entitled to kind of open exploitation. And especially when they're making deals behind the scenes with the National Security Agency. Okay? This is exploitation. To my mind, this has nothing to do with privacy. This has to do with your control over your data and what you do with it. Okay? And so for me, right, in the one context in which I have been talking about this in recent years has been in the context of what would Karl Marx need to do if he were alive now? Marx 2.0. Right? Because look, we've got a lot of nostalgic acts passing for Marx 2.0. The Slavoj Žižeks, the David Harveys, right? The people who are still arguing the 19th century battle about worker exploitation, right? And there's a lot of nostalgia about that, right? Which still operates on the assumption that the future economy is going to be industrial-based with very high kind of worker-labor inputs in that 19th century sense. And we still fight our politics largely in the same way in terms of protecting people's jobs. And insofar as unions remain to be strong, we're still very much in that 19th century setup. Marx 2.0 isn't about this at all. This is just nostalgia. The mode of production for value in society, for economic value in society, has moved quite decisively in the direction of information and communication technology. And so what we need to do under those circumstances is to redefine what exploitation means under those circumstances. And the exploitation that is going to be really of significance in our century is going to be the exploitation that you are ordinarily undergoing when you are in front of your keyboard, right? Where you are just generating data through your interactions with other people, which are available to Google and Amazon and all the rest and the National Security Agency and so forth. That is the exploitation. Okay? And the exploitation has really, to talk about in terms of privacy, is really to miss the point. Because look, if you had access to that data, you might do something interesting with it, right? You might be able to actually turn it into capital, as it were, okay? But if you don't have access to it, all you have is what other people do with it, then you are being exploited, okay? And if you look at the kinds of arguments that were had in the 19th century about how do we get beyond the exploitation of industrial labor? It is about, it's not about industrial workers not working anymore, but rather having control over the terms under which they work, the kinds of products they make, who they're sold to, all the rest of it. That was what it was about. That was what all, and that's what all those union negotiations were about in the 19th century as well. And we need something comparable with regard to the kind of world we're living in now, where the labor that's being exploited is not very arduous from a physical standpoint. In fact, most of us consider it quite pleasurable because everybody's spending hundreds of hours a day in front of a computer. Right? So it's not like we're suffering. It doesn't have that phenomenological character that it did in the 19th century. But nevertheless, it is just as exploitative from an economic standpoint. And so this is why, if we're talking about Marx 2.0, we have to shift. We have to shift frame here. And we have to get into this kind of mindset where we figure out exactly how can people use their own data as well as other people can. Okay? And there's an enormous power asymmetry that's there at the moment. Now, I know I've been speaking for a while, I guess for almost 30 minutes or so. I'm going to close on a point that, a small variant of this point. I won't talk for much longer. But it is an area where I published a book last year with Veronica Lipinska called The Proactionary Imperative. And this is part of a general thing I've been working on with regard to the future of humanity and what I call humanity 2.0. And this has a lot to do with the way human beings kind of rethink of their relationship to their bodies and themselves. And the area of information value that we talk about in that book has to do with biological, bioinformation, right? Genetic information, genomic information, information that is in fact increasingly and routinely being gathered about us, but again, who is in a position to use it? Now, there have been some very significant court cases at the international level that have involved the way in which the genomes of indigenous peoples have been used by big multinational corporations trying to develop drugs and things like that. So there's a lot of stuff on this, but I actually think that this matter is going to become of much more routine interest in the future to all sorts of people, because this bio data, right, which is going to be increasingly valuable, right, the more we learn about the genome, the more we learn about the way in which diseases are targeted to particular genetic sequences, right, the more this information, which at the moment we really can't do that much with, but nevertheless is going to be the basis on which the future biomedical innovations are going to be made, right? That is capital. That is capital in its almost purest sense. And this is something where people need to be able to, as it were, be born always already owners of that stuff. Because if they're not, if it's just treated as natural or something, then you're going to have all those big corporations coming in there and scooping that stuff up. And not only that, they'll have the governments on their side, because the governments are always scooping that stuff up too. And the more we get concerned about immigration issues and health issues, and you think about all these different issues that are very much in front of the political agenda today, a lot of the ways in which the decisions are going to be made are going to be involving this bio data. This will become increasingly important. And then so as a result, it becomes important that we actually have some kind of legislation where people are actually able to own this stuff and take control of the situation. Okay? I'm going to stop here. I think I've put enough on the table for you guys. So there you go. The value of the place of value in the world of information. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so spellbinding, I didn't even look at my watch. Can I take the first question? I won't abuse the chair's position and get in myself. A question from the floor. I'm going to bring in the coffee and tea whilst you talk.
Yes.
Right. You mentioned the ownership of the data and connected it to intellectual property. The question that I'm wondering about is really, what is data in this regard, and who or what exploits? When we think about intellectual property, that's something that I would create willingly and knowledgeably. I cannot own something that I didn't intend to create. When we create data, if we own data, this is something we haven't created. It's just a footprint, and someone else is picking up that footprint and taking a look at it. They And then they come to some view based on that footprint. And then they put something in our way saying, you may want to take a look at this, take a look at this. That, first of all, the first question is, what is that data?
Okay.
Because it's not in the sense of property or something produced by the intellect. And then we still, at the other end, have volition to determine whether the product or the event that's put in front of us is something that we want to pursue. It's just because we've left a footprint doesn't mean we have to follow a certain path.
Right. No. Let's go for the second point. The second point is, of course, true. The question is, who actually has the capacity to use data that you're generating? And my point is that this is, at the moment, the power, there is a power differential, and that other people, aka Google, Amazon, etc., can actually use the data you're generating more than you can, primarily because you don't even know what it is. You're just doing it. You don't know what exactly it is from the standpoint of how it fits into patterns and stuff like that. You don't have that information available to you. All you do is generate it, okay? So it's redressing that kind of, it's an asymmetry not only of power, but also of knowledge, right? In a sense that they know much more about you, in a sense, than you do, okay? But the other issue that you raised in the beginning, the first point, which I think is kind of, in a way, if you want to really get into this deeply, this is the question, you're raising exactly the right question. Because it is about, you might say, the metaphysics of intellectual property. And an intellectual property, there's no doubt about it, has a very strong distinction between what's invented and what's discovered, right? And I think that distinction has to be broken down, basically, and everything has to be seen as invented, right? And which is to say, then, that even when we're talking about human lives and so forth, these things are created, they are constructed, okay? And that the data that you generate through living is itself a kind of construction. It may not be a very self-conscious construction, but it is a construction, and in that respect, it counts as something that you do. And insofar as it counts as something that you do, then you have a kind of agency that at least prima facie gives you some kind of proprietary rights.
I don't understand that, because when we're talking about this creation of data, it's not something, again, like I said, I create. This data is created as my actions online come across certain algorithms.
No, I understand that. No. You're not solely creating. You're not the sole creator, but you certainly are the co-creator, right? Because the algorithms can already be there. Yeah. But if you're not online, nothing's going to happen, right? So there's a. So I'm not saying. My point is not to say that, you know, Amazon or Google should not have any kind of right to the data that they're enabling you to generate, which is kind of what your point is, right? I don't think they should, it's like they shouldn't have no rights, but you should have some rights, right? At the moment, you have no rights. So what we need is some kind of, you know, intellectual property legislation that allows for the recognition of co-ownership, co-production, right, in that formal sense. Because at the moment, you're just voluntarily giving up stuff. And while it's true that you get a benefit out of it, right, the point is you have no control over how that benefit's distributed.
Peter?
Yes?
Just kind of a superficial question. I mean, what role does data protection rule and the European Commission have in this? Because this seems to be a response. You know, maybe I missed this in the talk.
Well, I mean, the European Commission has been very much preoccupied with this issue of the right to forget. Right, the idea that data that you have in fact generated can somehow be gotten rid of and not available and not used against you. That's been the main legal context in which this issue has arisen for them. I think, again, that's a bit misguided too. But that's been, I mean, at least I'm just doing this from the top of my head, that's been the main way in which
the
this
new
has
come. Data protection regulation, though, seems to be about people owning the data that's held about them, held by corporations, about having some control over the data held about them. So that seems to, I mean, like, it kind of puts the state in as a player.
Yes, no, I think the state definitely needs to be put in as a player, but it has to be understood in a very broad... See, I actually think as soon as you get in front of a keyboard, you're already generating data. Mm-hmm. Right? So that this should not be, you know, insofar as there are these data protection laws, they should not be just restricted to certain kinds of interactions that you have. This should be quite general.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think the European Union's quite there yet.
Well, the new regulation pretty well is there. The one that's going to come in the next year or two.
Okay. Okay, we'll see what happens. We'll see what Google does about that.
They hate it.
I understand. On that issue, the Data Protection Directive Privacy Directive, which we then already implemented several years ago, has been described by Privacy International as almost completely useless.
Yeah.
So they can pass these grandiose laws, but will they actually be?
It's useless because it was drafted, it was created in the context of the 1970s model of our information sharing.
Well, this is a see, this is where, in a sense, we need to go back to ground zero and rethink what we mean by intellectual property in this new environment.
Yeah.
Right.
Robin.
Thanks. I like your idea of Marx 2.0, by the way. One of the things that strikes me about you stress the sort of the asymmetry of the relationship that we have with the people that collect data from our interactions in all sorts of ways. And that might be the way that we walk through supermarkets and our path through the aisles is recorded in order to, you know, move products around. But it strikes me that the value to us, there's another asymmetry, which is the value to me of that, even if I can see all the data that's collected by me by Google, Facebook, supermarkets, full-circuit TV and so on, actually that data isn't really useful information to me because there's very little that it will, as it were, enable decisions that will enable me to make individually. The implication seems to be that really that only becomes information, whether it's for Google or indeed for anybody else, when it's on a scale and it's aggregated and it's collectivized. So I wonder whether or not you have a view on what it is that we might do with the kinds of information
It's a great question. I guess I'm a bit of the school. I don't know if you're familiar with Douglas Rushkoff. Does that name mean anything to anyone?
Yeah.
Douglas Rushkoff, you must know who he is. Yeah, okay. So he's a kind of a information media theorist in New York University, and he's written this book called Program or Be Programmed. Okay? And his general strategy is the idea that people actually need to learn more as part of their self-empowerment. They need to learn more, in fact, how all this data that they're generating is being embedded. He's talking mostly in terms of trying to understand the computer programs, the algorithms themselves, in terms of how they work. But one can think about it in this context as well, namely that it would be very important for people to know, well, exactly how does Google integrate all this data from all these different people and come up with stuff? I mean, this is something that should, as it were, be public knowledge and people should be taught about, in the same spirit as one would, teach about consumer awareness or something like that, right? So there's a sense in, and insofar as we live in an age where the information and communication technology are forming the infrastructure through which we conduct our lives, I would have thought this kind of knowledge about what algorithms are being used, at least understanding the general principles, if not the actual mathematics, should be part of ordinary citizen education. That I would have thought that would be, a normal thing. I mean, we should be encouraging that kind of stuff.
But isn't Robin's point that the individual will own, if say you did have total rights to all the data you generated from the second you went online, okay, assuming that, you would still only have a very fragmented, valueless cache.
That's true, as long as
you... only useful combined
right.
big data, which leads me to think you need a response at the normative level to what the 19th century did with the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
We have to do it to the Information Revolution. They generated socialism, the cooperative movement, and other collective responses. So we need an analog of that for the digital era, because by itself, individual data has no value.
No.
What Google has recognized.
No, that's all true, right? But it is also possible for individual citizens to understand something about the way in which Google operates with all of this data, okay? And that is also part of the story, okay? Because it's true that, as long as, there are two things going on here, right? On the one hand, Google can't do much with the data unless it aggregates a lot of it according to its algorithms, okay? But at the same time, you can't do much with it either unless you understand kind of how one needs to think about this, right? How are they thinking about this to be able, because you may want to come up with alternative algorithms, and maybe these cooperative movements you're talking about might be able to do that, right? Ways in which people can voluntarily organize and, as it were, generate their own algorithms, which actually do, once they pool the data in a certain way, provide the kind of products that actually would be useful to people's lives, right? That's a possibility.
Yeah, I think, an example of that would be that if I'm constantly being served up adverts that suggest, because I've shown an interest in a particular part of Britain, that tell me how I can, get there by, some commercial transport link, people could club together to offer an alternative, which would offer me up carpooling arrangements that would get me to the same place with less environmental impact. But that would have to be a socially constructed response in order
to challenge
the commodification of
Exactly. This is exactly right. But you actually, I do think that in order to make this more than just a kind of niche thing, because you can always imagine it'll be very sophisticated people who'll be able to do this pretty soon, pretty easily, right? In order to make this a general public phenomenon, you actually have to put it in the education system. So the people are taught at an early age, look, guy, you know, you exist in this world. Data is being scooped up about you all the time. You're generating all kinds of data. This has to be part of people's self-understanding so they realize that they have a kind of responsibility to do something with it, because if they don't do something with it, somebody else will. I think people need to be taught this kind of thing and then to understand the ways in which this can happen. But it has to be made a general part of education. Because otherwise, what you're saying is absolutely right, but I, you know, at the moment, if we just do it that way, without the additional education, only relatively few elite clued-in people are going to benefit.
Hazel.
I've just got a comment to throw in there. I'm quite heavily involved with the Digital Economy Programme for Research Councils UK, and last year there was a stream of research projects funded under the banner of Digital Personhood. And at the moment, this group of people are based at Brunel doing a project called Digital Prosumer.
Uh-huh.
What they're looking at is how can we as individuals know about the information that we're generating, the kind of Rob's just been talking about, and actually own it to sell it. And that's this, I've just looked it up on the web. Go to Brunel, it's Panos Lubiaris.
Okay.
Who's doing that
stuff. Yeah, see, this
really,
is
really
this is along the right lines.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm, so all of that I get. What I'm still not getting quite is how this bears on, or how it, what it might say about the fact value distinction, which was
asserted
over 300 years ago in this city by Hume. So
yeah.
What does it mean?
What about that issue? Oh wow. No, I mean, look.
Because you brought that up in your.
I did. But this is where you have to think about what this is the commodification of value that we're arguing about here, right? Because when Google is taking up all of everybody's keystrokes. And amalgamating them to come up with something that'll enable them to sell products, what they're doing is they're commodifying values, okay? And the question then becomes, you know, what's your response to this, right? Because you end up then reshaping your values according to these things that then get sold to you. Okay, so the point here is, it's true. In a sense, we go back to the late 18th century with Kant, who is drawing on Hume to a certain extent. Right, you do have this kind of basic fact-value distinction. But what happens with the history of capitalism in the 19th century through commodification is that values get objectified and repackaged to people, and that ends up, in fact, narrowing what their value choices are and streamlining them in certain ways that certain people can actually benefit more from disproportionately vis-a-vis others.
Just the way the discussion is going, it seems that the response to this commodification is to have market competition in the use of information. But if it is about exploitation, should it not be a very process of commodification itself, which is under review, or at least under question?
I mean, I think the problem here is, and this is in a way, you know, when we acknowledge we live in a world of big data, this is where the problem comes in. Namely, there is always going to have to be a certain kind of, if we're going to live in a kind of coherent society, there's going to have to be some kind of aggregation of decisions and choices that people make. And that is going to end up turning values into commodification. Because you and I make very different individual choices, but then they get grouped together in various ways, and then they become certain things that are then made attractive to us, and we end up going for those things. I think in the kind of large-scale complex society, that's inevitable. Okay? So in this respect, commodification is to me not the problem in itself. The problem is the amount of power that you have over shaping what these commodities are. Okay? And I think that's where the issue, and to my mind, to be honest with you, I think to my mind, in the history of the 19th and 20th centuries, that was the debate between capitalism and socialism. Okay? Especially if we're talking about people who are still imagining that we're going to be living in societies of the kind of scale in which we live. Now, of course, there were a lot of socialists who wanted to downsize, downscale everything, and, you know, anarcho-communitarian, blah, blah, blah people, okay? But I'm not talking about those guys. I'm talking about people who still believe that we need to be living kind of at the scale, at the level of complexity at which we currently live, and that is a system that has been created by capitalism, but there is a socialist response to it.
Okay.
That's my point. Mm-hmm. And this is what, you know, all this Fabian socialism stuff is in a way was about this. All the stuff that you've been so keen on.
Yeah.
Right, because the Fabian socialists, right, those guys, right, they didn't deny capital. They thought capitalism, you know, was in fact an incredibly efficient mode of production. Right, and the question is, how can you actually, you know, as it were, re-engineer the state to actually enable it to develop, to deliver all of the goods that it's capable of delivering? Right, that was kind of what the Fabian socialist project was. In that respect, Fabian socialism is very much like New Labour, actually.
Who do you think is close? I mean, it's been said that if Marx was writing today, he would write not Das Kapital, but Das Information. Right?
Sure. Yes.
Is there anyone out there who you think might fulfill that role?
You!
Honestly, you!
Look, in a sense, I'm kind of, as it were, writing and speaking my way into this position. Because I have a lot of sympathy with the kind of Marxist story, but I do think because the mode of production has so decisively shifted from the industrial base to this new kind of base, where value is generated in a pretty radically different way, that we have to rethink Marx. And so that is, in a sense, what I'm offering. You know, whether I'm the guy who does it or I'm just sort of the John the Baptist, you know, that's another matter. But the point is, I do think that's the way it has to go. But the point I would make is, I don't see a lot of this, right? So in other words, if you see the people who normally call themselves Marxists who are still around, those dinosaurs stalking the earth, you know, the Marxists are still they're still fighting last century's battles, right? And I think you've got to kind of shift the focus to actually focus on information and communication technology as the primary mode of production. You have to start with that and then rebuild Marxism on the back of that and just get rid of the idea of the factory as the paradigm case of economic productivity.
Yeah. Anyone else?
I'm not.
No, Robin. Anyone else? So I'm just trying to bring others in if they want. Yeah, we can have you.
That's fair enough.
Anyone? Okay.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
Last chat.
No.
I just want to make a sort of slight case for Marx 1.5. I think it is possible to overstate the idea that information has created a new mode of production. You know, what we've got to accept in large parts of the world, the limiting case of the possibilities of human potential being realized still relate to the production of food.
Yes.
To the fundamental kind of, you know, surplus value that can be created that allows the intellectual specialization and division of labor that Marx himself thought would lead eventually to us being able to be a fisherman one day, a philosopher the next, and I'm misquoting it. So I just caution the idea that somehow, that if you like, those capital order production has been displaced by some new information mode of capitalism. So that's clearly not the case. That access to perfect information, which is Ricardo and Smith and economists think would sort of eradicate all the inefficiencies of market capitalism, doesn't allow somebody who's an exploitative position within a developing world country dependent on the export of cash crops, it doesn't matter the fact that they can get a better price for their squash down the road, now they've got a mobile phone, doesn't stop them being in a very complex chain of exploitative relationships in an industrial capitalist universe. Innovation doesn't of itself change that.
That is true. I don't disagree with this. I would say, though, that one of the things that I worry, what I want to warn against is this idea that those parts of the world that you're talking about have to somehow reproduce the experience of the West in order to get to an acceptable, non-exploitative level of information capitalism, okay? Because we can't actually afford to live in a world where all those developing countries end up going through the industrial phase in the way that we have, okay? So there's a sense in which the industrial paradigm of capitalism is not sustainable, okay, at all. And I think we should sort of unthink that as being a necessary stage. So you're absolutely right. There is all this exploitative stuff going on.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
Because Bell responded to that in The Coming of Post-Industrial Society, which was something of a Bible, to continue in the theological vein, about this paradigm shift. He said he's not saying the Industrial Revolution has been abrogated, you know, nullified, any more than the Industrial Revolution got rid of agriculture. But there's a new principle of development, a new paradigm, and it exists like a slide on top of the previous two slides of industrialization and agrarianism. So there's a new informational slide.
Yeah, but
it's like a palimpsest. It's a thickening.
Yeah, no, well, see, again, I don't think this is going to work for the third world. This is the problem, right? I think this is a very first world way of looking at the way in which we move from stage to stage in economic development. But I think what we have to countenance, I mean, again, you know, we haven't talked about the environmental issues and all the other things, because that's kind of what's it, that's the elephant in the room here. If we actually want to, as it were, recreate what Marx was concerned about in the 19th century, do we actually want more factories, more industry, and so forth in the developing world? We don't actually. We really do want to sort of change the way in which economic value is being produced in those places, even though we went through those kinds of stages. So it can't be like a palimpsest for those guys. Mm. It may have been for us, but it can't be for them. And I think we have to. And this is where I think one of the rigidities of Marxist theory, which interestingly, of course, in the Cold War era, guys like Bell and Walt Whitman Rostow and all these Cold War thinkers on the Western side, they all shared this, right? They all had the kind of view that you've just piled the modes of production on each other, right? And they all kind of coexist and one builds on the other and so forth. But I think in the kind of world we live in now, we have to in some way short-circuit the industrial for the developing world. And that's a really hard thing to sell because we haven't really come up with a paradigm case of what it's like to live a good life that doesn't presuppose a kind of industrial base. Okay? I can't imagine, because look at what's, you know, China, India, all these places, as they get increasingly industrialized, we have all this ecological issues coming on board.
But there are profound ethical issues about pulling up the drawbridge after you've achieved levels of, if you like, economic development.
Well, this is
kinds of pleasures and enjoyment.
I understand that, but this is where you've got to break. This is where the determinism of it, the determinism of the old Marxist story, has to be. I think it has to be short-circuited. I mean, I realize how hard it is for people who love Marx, but I think we just can't. We can't imagine that we can't live in a world like that. And that's what makes it, I think, very tricky. And so it is interesting. I mean, the point you were raising when you first introduced this line of discussion about, you know, all these third world guys with their mobile phones being able to make trades and things like that, that's kind of interesting in a way, because in a sense, you have simultaneously, you've got the kind of agricultural regime and you've got the info regime kind of working together, right? And what's in the middle isn't necessarily industry as such, but the kind of exploitative relations that kind of come from industry, and that has to be stopped. That's kind of the way I see the situation. But whether they need to be producing industrially stuff is another matter. I don't see that as necessary. I think we, in a sense, we should think increasingly of downsizing industrialization altogether. And this is why I think the labor unions, insofar as they still exist today, that I think that unions have to really rethink what they're about, because I think they're still too much tied to particular industries, particular trades, which in a sense, from the standpoint of the future creation of value, may not really exist. And we're, as a result, we're just artificially propping up stuff. And I'm thinking about this in the context in the United States, where I'm from, the United States automobile industry. Okay? Obama won the last election because he promised to save the jobs in Detroit. Okay? Why? Right? That just delayed more efficient energy technologies, information-based stuff by 10 years. Okay? So this is the kind of thing we have to be thinking about sort of seriously here, right? And we have to think about who's actually on the side of the direction history is going and who's behind. And I realize that's a very tricky issue from an ideological standpoint. But what we should not be doing is propping up an industrial economy. That's why I was...
Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard. I'm a very futuristic thinker. I was amazed you didn't know I was going to cite Aristotle.
No, I didn't.
He then based his talk on it. I mean, I could never do that. You're seeing, I think, one of the most engaging speakers around today, and I think the content, or hearing, I should say, the content of what he has said and what you have joined in discussing is terribly important. I don't think any of us can deny that. Steve, thank you for making a huge contribution.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Thank you for coming up here, staying overnight from Warwick, and he's got a plane to catch, so I think we will call it a day. There is coffee and tea for those of you who want to stay behind, but I think we should formally close it now in the usual way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.